Hello, you are listening to KVNF, Mountain Grown Community Radio, and Local Motion, our weekly public affairs show. For KVNF News, I'm Eric Gould. Thanks so much for joining us. In this edition of Local Motion, we'll hear from our partners at the Rocky Mountain Community Radio Exchange. KVNF is part of this collection of community radio stations, most of them on the West Slope. We combine resources to provide capital coverage, our reporting from the state capitol, where Scott Franz is one of the only reporters in Colorado covering that beat full-time. Here on Local Motion, we'll get a sampling of stories around the region about a variety of topics. Late last month, the Bureau of Land Management released its final draft resource management plan for the Uncompahgre Field Office. The BLM's Uncompahgre Field Office oversees more than 675,000 acres of surface lands and nearly 1 million acres of federal mineral estate in Montrose, Ouray, Delta, San Miguel, and Mesa counties. The document represents years of work and would guide land use planning decisions on these public lands for decades to come. The RMP final draft clocks in at 3,700 pages, and the BLM allows 30 days of review and protest for parties that commented during the plan's last phase. This formal protest period closes Monday, July 29th. From Carbondale, KDNK's Raleigh Burley has more on why environmental groups and local governments are raising concerns.
The BLM's resource management plan for the Uncompahgre Field Office oversees more than 675,000 acres of surface lands and nearly 1 million acres of federal mineral estate in Montrose, Ouray, Delta, San Miguel, and Mesa counties.
We began engaging with our partners and the public for the draft Uncompahgre RMP EIS through a formal public scoping process in February 2010. And we continued with a formal public comment period for the draft RMP and environmental impact statement in June 2016.
Jason Berengen is the lead public affairs specialist for the BLM Colorado State Office. According to Berengen, the current plan is the culmination of years of public input.
This plan would not have been possible without the public's input, and the BLM is very excited to begin implementation.
The BLM estimates that the directives in this draft would contribute approximately $2.5 billion in economic output while supporting 950 jobs over the next 20 years.
Sustainable energy development is a strong component and facet of this plan, which increases access to areas where energy resources are present in a responsible manner. Recreation in the area is also very important, and the plan increases access for activities like OHV use, fishing, rafting, hunting, hiking, horseback riding, rock crawling, and mountain biking.
Despite these projected advantages by the BLM, Colorado environmental groups and some local governments argue that this draft plan prioritizes the Trump administration's energy dominance policy by favoring oil and gas, coal, and uranium development on public lands.
The BLM looked at a range of alternatives, including a sub-alternative that was proposed, which restricted oil and gas leasing in the North Fork Valley from the Citizens for a Healthy Community and environmental interest group in Delta County. And the BLM, we very much appreciated their input. We also heard from the Delta County Commissioners, a cooperating agency that represents the broader community in the area. And Delta County supports all forms of responsible energy development on public lands and formally told the BLM that a diverse energy portfolio is critical for homeland security and a strong economy.
Nonetheless, environmental groups and some local governments, like Gunnison County Commissioners, as cited in a recent article by Crested Butte News, object that this latest and final draft is substantially different than what was previously provided for comment, and that it includes policy alternatives introduced without public input.
It is unlike any environmental impact statement I've seen in the 20 years of my life doing this kind of work.
Pete Kolbenschlag founded the Paonia-based environmental nonprofit Colorado Farm and Food Alliance. He is among groups speaking out against what some consider to be a curveball in the drafting process.
The agency claims that it's within the range of alternatives that was considered in the draft plan. I think that's a pretty creative way to look at it.
The document is 3,700 pages and allows only 30 days of review and protest for parties that commented during the plan's last phase.
And to issues that were raised in those earlier comments.
Though the formal protest period closes on Monday, July 29th, the Federal Lands Policy and Management Act provides Colorado Governor Jared Polis a total of 60 days to review the draft resource management plan and comment on its consistency with state priorities and policies.
That said, it's always a good time to let land managers and other folks know if you're disappointed with the direction they're taking the public lands. They're public employees. They're working on the public dime, and the public has an opportunity to talk to them in lots of different ways, and we should use that.
For KDNK News, I'm Raleigh Burley.
Next here on our show, we'll hear two stories from Connecting the Drops, our ongoing series about water and water issues in the West. Multiple water projects in Colorado are battling a permitting process designed to increase local control over development projects. From Boulder, KGNU's Hannah Lee Myers brings us this Connecting the Drops report on 1041 powers and the role they're playing in two controversial Colorado water use proposals.
Bulking up local control over natural resource projects is currently a major focus in Colorado. One tool county and city leadership are using to exercise local authority over water development is the 1041 permitting process. Seasoned local government land use attorney and 1041 regulations expert Gerald Dahl of the law firm Murray, Dahl, Beery & Renault in Lakewood, Colorado, explains 1041 powers, regulations, and permits this way.
1041 powers are the law that the legislature granted or adopted in 1974, establishing this enabling authority for counties and municipalities. 1041 regulations are regulations counties and municipalities adopt pursuant to that authority. 1041 permits are permits which are issued by counties and municipalities that have 1041 regulations, and those permits are issued for specific projects. One thing that 1041, I think, has provided for counties and some municipalities in Colorado is a seat at the table. Prior to the ability to have this kind of regulation, very often counties and municipalities watched a project happen and had no real role.
The Boulder County Commissioners are requiring Denver Water undergo their 1041 permitting process for the utility's controversial proposal to triple the size of Gross Reservoir in what would be the county's largest construction project to date. Denver Water is now suing the Boulder Commissioners over that demand. Another major 1041 permitting battle is playing out in the Larimer County, Fort Collins area.
Good evening. I'm going to call to order this meeting, the Larimer County Board of Commissioners. The board is here to consider the Thornton 1041 water line application.
Late 2016, early 2017, the city of Thornton, home to around 140,000 people, began public engagement on a proposal to build a pipeline to send water it purchased in the 1980s from reservoirs north of Fort Collins to Thornton to serve their growing population. After Larimer County Commissioners rejected Thornton's original proposed pipeline route, the city put together a working group and hired an independent facilitator to try to work out an agreement with the Larimer County community and meet the county-crafted regulations outlined in their local 1041 permit process. In February 2019, the Larimer County Commissioners issued a unanimous vote on the revised Thornton Water Project proposal. Commissioner Steve Johnson explained the overarching reasoning behind their decision.
We must make a finding that a 1041 permit meets every one of those 12 criteria if we are to and issue that permit. I think Larimer County recognizes your right to this water and remains willing to collaborate and work with you on a proposal that does meet these criteria, but I cannot support this proposal tonight.
Specifically, the commissioner cited health, safety, environmental, and local benefit concerns for their no vote. Todd Barnes, communications director for the city of Thornton, says although the public engagement the 1041 permitting process allows is a good thing, Thornton feels the voices of those opposed to the project may have overshadowed the details and outweighed the voices of the Larimer County staff that recommended approval.
We went through a thorough examination of the record and of everything we submitted, and we felt like they didn't even follow their own guidelines, and you know, all this is going to get played out in court and a judge is going to get to decide all this stuff. But from Thornton's perspective, we don't think that the commissioners did as good of a job as their staff at looking through everything we presented in the record.
Two opposition groups, Save the Pooter and No Pipe Dream, are pushing Thornton to adopt an alternative plan, allowing future and current water diversions from the Pooter River to run downstream to a takeout point past Fort Collins, improving the ecological health of the Pooter and removing the need for the pipeline. But Thornton is steadfastly opposed to the Pooter River option, saying it would degrade the quality of the clean drinking water they're entitled to that's currently housed in reservoirs north of Fort Collins.
This is where the water, if they get a pipeline, they want it, the water to come from here.
That's former Larimer County Commissioner Karen Wagner. She's part of the No Pipe Dream group that, along with Save the Pooter, is attempting to join the lawsuit over the Thornton Water Project on behalf of the Larimer Commissioner's decision not to issue the 1041 permit. Wagner says, just like in the 1041 process, they should have the right to join the debate, regardless of Thornton's opposition to their involvement in the legal proceedings.
They're questioning our standing, but we don't have any doubt that the judge will allow our motion to intervene because we've been a part of all these hearings. We've done all the research. We've done all the CORA requests to try to understand this. So we don't want to be left out of the process, and we don't want to see Larimer County settle out of court on something that the public would not have any input on. So if you overturn our denial, then you need to send the application back to Larimer County to start over again. And that would be acceptable. That would prolong our work for another year or two, but we'd be back.
It may seem like 1041 permit disputes over water projects are on the rise. Another 1041 case is currently playing out in Bent County over a water deal between Arkansas River Farms and the Lower Arkansas River Management Association. As localities see other communities control water development in their area with 1041 powers, more cities and counties are writing their own 1041 regulations. But land use attorney Gerald Dahl says the current focus on 1041 powers in Colorado is part of a greater trend in water use projects.
It's not about the regulatory tool being applied to the project. It's about the project. And if there is a trend, it is that major project proponents have learned and are still learning that the difference now is that they must pay attention to the local community in whatever way the local community finds to express itself. Sometimes that's 1041, sometimes it's traditional zoning. But in any event, a major project needs to take note of and deal with and work with, to the greatest extent possible, the local community. And if anything is different, it's that.
Both Denver Water in their proposal to expand Gross Reservoir in Boulder and those leading the Thornton Water Project say they care about and are listening to concerned communities. Some of the public is challenging those claims, but with 1041 powers at play and locals more involved than ever in water issues, both sides of water development projects are going to need quite a bit of patience and persistence. For Connecting the Drops and Rocky Mountain Community Radio, I'm Hanley Myers.
And if you're just joining us, you're listening to KVNF, Mountain Grown Community Radio. I'm Eric Gould. In another story from Connecting the Drops here on Local Motion, former adversaries in a fight over a dam on the South Platte River say they hope their ability to find common ground will leave a legacy of compromise in water projects in Colorado. Hannah Lee Myers has more.
For most of the 19th century, dam construction was the dominant solution to water issues in the United States.
The river had to be regulated, controlled in a year-round flow. No more floods, no more droughts.
But in 1990, the Environmental Protection Agency vetoed the construction of the Two Forks Dam, solidifying a decline in major dam construction that began with the enforcement of EPA and Clean Water Act standards. The Two Forks project was for a 539-foot reservoir to be built in the pristine Cheeseman Canyon, located at the confluence of the North and South Forks of the South Platte River. Denver Water said the dam was necessary to meet the needs of a booming Front Range population. Environmentalists claimed the dam would cause unnecessary damage to wetlands and wildlife areas. The EPA agreed with the conservationists, an unprecedented move many water experts say set water management on a completely new course.
This was a big deal when this veto occurred.
One such expert is Tom Check, director of the One World, One Water Center for Urban Water Education and Stewardship at Metropolitan State University of Denver.
And so with the EPA and the environmental impact statements and so forth, environmental protection, you had to get permits to construct a project like this to show that you were doing the best you can to protect the environment, basically. So when this permit was vetoed, this was like an incredible wake-up call to the water development community. It's like, wow, no longer business as usual. What are we going to do now?
At a recent Two Forks retrospective conference in Denver, most of the key players in the Two Forks conflict, including Denver Water leadership, environmental activists, as well as current and former EPA administrators, met to reflect on the project over two decades later. As director of planning at Denver Water when Two Forks was vetoed, Dave Little was originally strongly opposed to the EPA's decision and the environmentalists fighting the project.
And if you look at Denver Water's history up to the Two Forks time, Denver Water traditionally would build treatment capacity and then build a reservoir, build treatment capacity and then build a reservoir. And that's the path that we were on at that time. What we did not recognize at that time was that the world was changing. All the environmental laws were just starting to come into effect. We viewed the environmental community as just being, in essence, obstructionists. So we never had a dialogue.
Now, Little recognizes the vital impact of losing the Two Forks battle.
So the veto was an inflection point for Denver Water, and it has made us a better organization. I'd like to thank all my opposition on the panel for showing us that there are other ways of developing water resources and working with environmental issues in a way that is not a war.
The panelists seem to agree that the biggest takeaway from Two Forks was that collaboration would be necessary to address water scarcity. EPA, Trout Unlimited, and other environmental leaders are calling a current proposal to triple the size of Gross Reservoir in Boulder County a collaborative win coming from the Two Forks battle, saying increasing the capacity of an existing dam minimizes environmental harm otherwise caused by the construction of new dams. But not everyone is pleased. Boulder residents are protesting the Gross expansion, which would be the largest construction project in the county's history. Multiple environmental groups have filed a lawsuit to stop the project, and the Boulder County commissioners are now requiring Denver Water go through a local permitting process for the project. Denver Water is now suing Boulder over that decision. The water needed to fill an expanded Gross reservoir would come from an already strained Fraser River in Grand County, a proposal that set the stage for another water war. But Trout Unlimited and Grand County now support the Colorado River Cooperative Agreement that both allows Denver Water to increase diversions from the Fraser while also guaranteeing the river will be saved from ecological collapse already in motion. Former Grand County manager Loreline Underbrink-Curran says, part of the spirit of the Two Forks era of water compromise involves working together for the best realistic solutions, even if some are uneasy about new alliances between communities, environmental groups, and the water utilities that own all the water rights.
If you oppose the project, what do you propose to fix the Fraser and the Colorado Rivers? I haven't heard anything yet, so you know, maybe we played the best cards we were dealt. Maybe we are dancing with the devil. But I don't think it's worked out that way. And I am in support of the Colorado River Cooperative Agreement and think it will be monumental in Colorado's history as we move forward with a finite resource.
Although dam construction in the U.S. has slowed and collaboration has improved, the question remains, can more be done to eliminate the need for new dams and dam expansions? Former EPA Assistant Administrator for Water, Luana Wilcher, thinks so and shared an experience she had in Denver right after the Two Forks veto that highlighted an example.
There was a woman standing up talking about how important the dam was and how Denver residents needed the water, and a thunderstorm came up outside. So she couldn't see that it was pouring the rain outside. But then the icing on the cake was when the city's automatic lawn sprinklers came on in the middle of the thunderstorm. And I thought, you know, maybe there really is something more they could do on water conservation out here.
But one audience member asked, even with improved water conservation and collaborative management plans, is enough being done to address the overallocation of water and growing population crisis?
Where do you draw the line where we tell a community there's no more water left? We only have so much that we can develop.
A question Dave Little, former director of planning at Denver Water, couldn't answer.
Everything is going to be sacrificed for growth, and I don't know how to stop that. I have no idea how to stop that.
The Two Forks Dam was vetoed nearly three decades ago by a federal agency seeking to protect the environment. Now, that same agency, the EPA, is reviewing directives from its former head, Scott Pruitt, to limit the agency's veto authority under the Clean Water Act. Bill Riley, the former EPA administrator that vetoed Two Forks, wonders how the EPA would respond to the Two Forks debate in the current political climate.
It's unthinkable. There are things I don't understand that are happening now and that I do regret. I do tend to believe that there are cycles. I'm often asked what my advice is to senior people at EPA now. It's very much stay the course if you can. My period coincided with an opportunity to do something very different. It was our moment. It was a moment to innovate. It was a moment when the president smiled on our agency. Those moments will come again.
There's undoubtedly still conflict in Colorado around new water projects and dam construction. But those who were part of Two Forks say they hope the legacy of the project will be one of compromise and environmental respect that's vital to solving the threat of water scarcity. For Connecting the Drops and Rocky Mountain Community Radio, I'm Hanley Myers.
Connecting the Drops is a collaboration between Rocky Mountain Community Radio Stations and Water Education Colorado. Find out more at watereducationcolorado.org. Support is provided by CoBank, which provides financing solutions for rural water systems. Find out more at cobank.com.
And it's KVNF, Mountain Grown Community Radio. Finally, here on this edition of Local Motion, we'll go to Moab, Utah. Throughout the 1950s, the Atomic Energy Commission tested nuclear weapons in a remote area of the Nevada desert. At the time, communities situated downwind were told this project was safe and would have no impact on public health. Now, over 60 years later, Utahans are coming forward to document their stories in the fallout of nuclear testing. Molly Marcello from KZMU in Moab has the story.
Imagine it's 1951. You're 8 years old, living in the then sleepy town of St. George, Utah. You're in school, and your teacher has just walked you and your entire class to the playground because something is happening outside, something big, and the whole school has gathered to see it.
And we've seen the flicker. We did see type of a mushroom go up. And after that was over, we went out and played. That was our time to go out and have recess. I had the feeling that it wasn't good. I didn't know, just being a child. I thought, why would they do that? Why would they send things up in the air? And that was just my thoughts as a child.
Bonnie Deem, this is her memory, living through the era of nuclear testing. From January 1951 through October 1958, the United States performed 119 nuclear tests at what was known as the Nevada Test Site, situated 135 miles west of St. George. During these detonations, large amounts of debris were drawn up into the atmosphere, which contained radioactive substances. That radiation would then be carried many, many miles away by wind, returning to the ground as fallout. In the months, years, and yes, decades after nuclear testing, evidence of fallout contamination grew, appearing in the environment, in animals, and humans living downwind. They're known as downwinders.
I have lost many of my school buddies, even the younger ones that were there, and it was due to cancer. My sister passed away with cancer of the liver at 34. My brother, just a little bit older than her, passed away with stomach cancer. My mother had cancer. I have had cancer. It just seems like that area, that group of us, have all of us contracted cancer. The doctors have all said it is from radiation, over amount of radiation. And so if you know where it came from, the government did a bad job for all of us.
Bonnie's firsthand experience with nuclear fallout and its effects is one of now over 40 stories collected in an ongoing project at the J. Willard Marriott Library through the University of Utah.
So my name is Justin Sorensen. I am the GIS specialist for the J. Willard Marriott Library at the University of Utah. I actually am the creator of this archive, so yeah.
Sorensen and his colleagues visited southeastern Utah this spring to collect more oral histories from local downwinders. Although only residents living in certain Utah counties are eligible for government compensation, the term downwinders applies to anyone who lived downwind from nuclear weapons testing. Richard Miller's famous map depicting areas crossed by radioactive clouds in the nuclear era shows fallout in every single state, but Utah is almost entirely covered.
You know, like I said, at first it just started as, you know, mapping to see this data and where different areas of Utah were impacted, but I started learning more about these people, the downwinder people, and it just, I don't know, it's just something that was really interesting to me. It's something I hadn't learned in school, and I just wanted to continue expanding upon that. With this archive, we're just hoping that we can preserve, you know, these stories, let future generations know what happened, but also keep the voice of these people alive.
This is a little booklet I had, which I actually brought back home from my first day of kindergarten in 1957, that the government had give to everybody in town, and it's called Atomic Tests in Nevada.
Preston Truman, who goes by Jay, one of the downwinders in the archive. During the nuclear testing era, the Atomic Energy Commission denied that these tests were harmful to public health, even as outside scientists and researchers, beginning in the late 1950s, started proving that they were. But secrecy and denial prevailed for years because the Atomic Energy Act of 1954 allowed the commission to act as both developer and safety regulator of nuclear weapons. In his oral history interview, Jay reads from his official government-issued booklet.
Nevada tests have helped us make great progress in a few years and have been a vital factor in maintaining the peace of the world. Some of you have been inconvenienced by our test operations. Nevertheless, you have accepted them without fuss and without alarm. Your cooperation has helped to achieve an unusual record of safety. To our knowledge, no one outside the test site has been hurt in 6 years of testing. That is really, you know, stinks. It really says it all, especially when right now they have paid $1.4 billion in compensation already to downwinders in that area. And there's many, many more out there.
The Downwinders of Utah Archive contains oral histories, presentations, as well as an extensive interactive timeline on the nuclear era. You can visit the archive at lib.utah.edu. Reporting from southeastern Utah, I'm Molly Marcello.
And that brings this edition of Local Motion to a close. For KVNF News, I'm Eric Gould. Thanks so much for listening.